his lordship said. "Your son and my nephew were lost with countless other good men. The war itself was lost that day, sir." "This man is defeated." Davos remembered Melisande's talk of embers and the ashes igniting great blazes. Small wonder he ended here. "His grace will never yield, my lord." "Folly, that's folly." Lord Alistair sat on the floor again, as if the effort of standing for a moment had been too much for him. "Stannis Baratheon will never sit the Iron Throne. Is it treason to say the truth? A bitter truth, but no less true for that. His feet is gone, save for the Lyseni, and Salazar Sam will flee at the first sight of a Lannister's hail. Most of the lords who supported Stannis have gone over to Joffrey, or died. Even the lords of the Narrow Sea, the lords sworn to Dragonstone." Lord Alistair waved his hand feebly. "Lord Celtigar was captured and bent the knee. Montfort Valerian died with his ship. The Red Woman burned Sunglass, and Lord Bar-Eamon is 15 fat and feeble. Those are your lords of the Narrow Sea. Only the strength of House Florin is left to Stannis, against all the might of Highgarden, Sunspear, and Castle Rock. And now most of the Storm Lords as well. The best hope that remains is to try and salvage something with a peace. That is all I meant to do. Gods be good, how can they call it treason?" Davos stood frowning. "My lord, what did you do?" "Not treason. Never treason. I love his grace as much as any man. My own niece is his queen, and I remain loyal to him when wiser men fled. I am his hand. The hand of the king. How can I be a traitor? I only meant to save our lives and honour. Yes." He licked his lips. "I penned a letter. Salador San swore that he had a man who could get it to King's Landing to Lord Tywin. His lordship is a man of reason, and my terms were fair, more than fair."
"What terms were these, my lord?"
"It is filthy here," Lord Alistair said suddenly. "And that odour, what is that odour?"
"A pale," said Davos, gesturing. "We have no privy here. What terms?"
His lordship stared at the pale in horror.
"That Lord Stannis give up his claim to the Iron Throne and retract all he said of Joffrey's bastardy, on the condition that he be accepted back into the king's peace and confirmed as Lord of Dragonstone and Storm's End. I vow to do the same, for the return of Brightwater Keep and all our lands. I thought Lord Tywin would see the sense in my proposal. He still has the Starks to deal with, and the Iron Men as well. I offer to seal the bargain by wedding Shireen to Joffrey's brother Tommen." He shook his head. "The terms, they were as good as we are ever like to get. Even you can see that, surely."
"Yes," said Davos, "even me." Unless Stannis should father a son, such a marriage would mean that Dragonstone and Storm's End would one day pass to Tommen, which would doubtless please Lord Tywin. Meanwhile, the Lannisters would have Shireen as hostage to make certain Stannis raise no new rebellions.
"And what did his grace say when you proposed these terms to him?"
"He's always with the Red Woman, and he's not in his right mind, I fear. This talk of a stone dragon, madness. I tell you, sheer madness. Did we learn nothing from Arian Brightfire? From the Nine Majors, from the Alchemists? Did we learn nothing from Summer Hall? No good has ever come from these dreams of dragons. I told Axel as much. My way was better, surer, and Stannis gave me his seal. He gave me leave to rule. The hand speaks with a king's voice."
"Not in this."
Davos was no courtier, and he did not even try to blunt his words.
"It is not in Stannis to yield, so long as he knows his claim is just.
no more than he can unsay his words against Joffrey when he believes them true. As for the marriage, Tommen was born of the same incest as Joffrey, and his grace would sooner see Shireen dead than wed to such.
A vein throbbed in Florence's forehead.
He has no choice.
Oh, you are wrong, my lord. He can choose to die a king.
And us with him? Is that what you desire, Onion Knight?
No, but I am the king's man, and I will make no peace without his leave.
Lord Alistair stared at him helplessly for a long moment, and then began to weep. John. The last night fell black and moonless, but for once the sky was clear. "I'm going up the hill to look for Ghost," he told the Thens at the cave mouth, and they grunted and let him pass. "So many stars," he thought, as he trudged up the slope through pines and firs and ash. Maester Lewin had taught him his stars as a boy at Winterfell. He had learned the names of the 12 houses of heaven and the rulers of each. He could find the 7 wanderers sacred to the faith. He was old friends with the Ice Dragon, the Shadow Cat, the Moon Maid, and the Sword of the Morning. All those he shared with Ygritte, but not some of the others. We look up at the same stars and see different things. The King's Crown was the cradle, to hear her tell it. The Stallion was the Horned Lord. The Red Wanderer, that Septons preached was sacred to their smith up here, was called the Thief. And when the Thief was in the Moon Maid, that was a propitious time for a man to steal a woman, Ygritte insisted. Like the night you stole me, the Thief was bright that night. I never meant to steal you, he said. I never knew you were a girl until my knife was at your throat.
If you kill a man and never meant it, he's just as dead,
Ygritte said stubbornly. John had never met anyone so stubborn, except maybe for his little sister Arya.
Is she still my sister? He wondered. Was she ever?
He had never truly been a Stark, only Lord Eddard's motherless bastard, with no more a place at Winterfell than Theon Greyjoy. And even that he'd lost. When a man of the Night's Watch said his words, he put aside his old family and joined a new one. But Jon Snow had lost those brothers too. He found Ghost atop the hill, as he thought he might. The White Wolf never howled, yet something drew him to the heights all the same, and he would squat there on his hindquarters, hot breath rising in a white mist as his red eyes drank the stars. "Do you have names for them as well?" John asked, as he went to one knee beside the direwolf and scratched the thick white fur on his neck. "The hare, the doe, the she-wolf." Ghost licked his face, his rough, wet tongue rasping against the scabs where the eagle's talons had ripped John's cheek. "The bird marked both of us," he thought. "Ghost," he said quietly, "on the morrow we go over. There's no steps here, no cage and crane, no way for me to get you to the other side. We have to part. Do you understand?" In the dark, the direwolf's red eyes looked black. He nuzzled at John's neck, silent as ever, his breath a hot mist. The wildlings called Jon Snow a warg, but if so, he was a poor one. He did not know how to put on a wolfskin, the way Orel had with his eagle before he died. Once John had dreamed that he was Ghost, looking down upon the valley of the Milkwater where Mance Rayder had gathered his people, and that dream had turned out to be true. But he was not dreaming now, and that left him only words. "You cannot come with me," John said, cupping the wolf's head in his hands and looking deep into those eyes. "You have to go to Castle Black, you understand? Castle Black? Can you find it? The way home? Just follow the ice, east and east, into the sun, and you'll find it. They will know you at Castle Black, and maybe your coming will warn them."
He had thought of writing out a warning for ghosts to carry, but he had no ink, no parchment, not even a writing quill, and the risk of discovery was too great. "I will meet you again at Castle Black, but you have to get there by yourself. We must each hunt alone for a time. Alone." The direwolf twisted free of John's grasp, his ears pricked up, and suddenly he was bounding away. He loped through a tangle of brush, leapt to deadfall, and raced down the hillside, a pale streak among the trees. "Off to Castle Black?" John wondered. "Or off after Hare?" He wished he knew. He feared he might prove just as poor a warg as a sworn brother and a spy. A wind sighed through the trees, rich with the smell of pine needles, tugging at his faded blacks. John could see the wall looming high and dark to the south, a great shadow blocking out the stars. The rough hilly ground made him think they must be somewhere between the Shadow Tower and Castle Black, and likely closer to the former. For days they had been wending their way south, between deep lakes that stretched like long, thin fingers along the floors of narrow valleys, while flint ridges and pine-clad hills jostled against one another to either side. Such ground made for slow riding, but offered easy concealment for those wishing to approach the wall unseen. "For wilding raiders," he thought, "like us, like me." Beyond the wall lay the Seven Kingdoms, and everything he had sworn to protect. He had said the words, had pledged his life and honour, and by rights he should be up there standing sentry. He should be raising a horn to his lips to rouse the night's watch to arms. He had no horn, though. It would not be hard to steal one from the wildlings, he suspected, but what would that accomplish? Even if he blew it, there was no one to hear. The wall was 100 leagues long, and the watch sadly dwindled. All but 3 of the strongholds had been abandoned. There might not be a brother within 40 miles of here but for John, if he was a brother still. I should have tried to kill Mansraider on the fist, even if it meant my life. That was what Corin Halfhand would have done. But John had hesitated, and the chance had passed. The next day he had ridden off with Stir the Magnar, Jarl, and more than 100 picked Thens and raiders. He told himself that he was only biding his time, that when the moment came he would slip away and ride for Castle Black. The moment never came. They rested most nights in empty wildling villages, and Stir always set a dozen of his Thens to guard the horses. Jarl watched him suspiciously, and regret was never far, day or night. 2 hearts that beat as one. Mansraider's mocking words rang bitter in his head. John had seldom felt so confused. "I have no choice," he told himself the first time, when she slipped beneath his sleeping skins. "If I refuse her, she will know me for a turncloak. I'm playing the part the Halfhand told me to play." His body had played the part eagerly enough. His lips on hers, his hand sliding under her doeskin shirt to find a breast, his manhood stiffening when she rubbed her mound against it through their clothes. "My vows," he'd thought, remembering the weirwood grove where he had said them, the 9 great white trees in a circle, the carved red faces watching, listening. But her fingers were undoing his laces, and her tongue was in his mouth, and her hand slipped inside his small clothes and brought him out, and he could not see the weirwoods any more, only her. She bit his neck, and he nuzzled hers, burying his nose in her thick red hair. "Lucky," he thought. "She is lucky. Fire-kissed." "Isn't that good?" she whispered as she guided him inside her. She was sopping wet down there, and no maiden, that was plain, but John did not care. His vows, her maidenhood, none of it mattered, only the heat of her, the mouth on his, the finger that pinched at his nipple. "Isn't that sweet?" she said again. "Not so fast. Oh, slow, yes, like that. There now, yes. Sweet. You know nothing, Jon Snow, but I can show you. Harder now. Yes.
A part, he tried to remind himself afterwards. I am playing a part. I had to do it once to prove I'd abandoned my vows. I had to make her trust me. It need never happen again. He was still a man of the Night's Watch and a son of Eddard Stark. He'd done what needed to be done, proved what needed to be proven. The proving had been so sweet, though, and Ygritte had gone to sleep beside him with her head against his chest, and that was sweet as well, dangerously sweet. He thought of the weirwoods again, and the words he'd said before them. It was only once, and it had to be. Even my father stumbled once, when he forgot his marriage vows and sired a bastard. John vowed to himself that it would be the same with him. It will never happen again. It happened twice more that night, and again in the morning, when she woke to find him hard. The wildlings were stirring by then, and several could not help but notice what was going on beneath the pile of furs. Jarl told them to be quick about it before he had to throw a pail of water over them. Like a pair of rutting dogs, John thought afterwards. Was that what he'd become? I am a man of the Night's Watch, a small voice inside insisted. But every night it seemed a little fainter, and when Ygritte kissed his ears or bit his neck, he could not hear it at all. Was this how it was for my father? He wondered. Was he as weak as I am, when he dishonored himself in my mother's bed? Something was coming up the hill behind him, he realized suddenly. For half a heartbeat he thought it might be Ghost come back, but the direwolf never made so much noise. John drew Longclaw in a single smooth motion. But it was only one of the Thens, a broad man in a bronze helm.
"Snow," the intruder said. "Come, Magna wants."
The men of Then spoke the old tongue, and most had only a few words of the common. John did not much care what the Magnar wanted, but there was no use arguing with someone who could scarce understand him, so he followed the man back down the hill. The mouth of the cave was a cleft in the rock, barely wide enough for a horse, half concealed behind a soldier pine. It opened to the north so the glows of the fires within would not be visible from the wall. Even if by some mischance a patrol should happen to pass atop the wall tonight, they would see nothing but hills and pines and the icy sheen of starlight on a half-frozen lake. Mansraider had planned his thrust well. Within the rock the passage descended 20 feet before it opened out onto a space as large as Winterfell's great hall. Cook fires burned amongst the columns, their smoke rising to blacken the stony ceiling. The horses had been hobbled along one wall beside a shallow pool. A sinkhole in the centre of the floor opened on what might have been an even greater cavern below, though the darkness made it hard to tell. John could hear the soft rushing sound of an underground stream somewhere below as well. Jarl was with the Magnar. Mance had given them the joint command. Stir was none too pleased by that, John had noted early on. Mansraider had called the dark youth a pet of Val, who was sister to Darla, his own queen, which made Jarl a sort of good brother once removed to the king beyond the wall. The Magnar plainly resented sharing his authority. He had brought 100 Thens, 5 times as many as Jarl, and often acted as if he had the sole command. But it would be the younger man who got them over the ice, John knew. Though he could not have been older than 20, Jarl had been raiding for 8 years and had gone over the wall 12 times with the likes of Alfin Crowkiller and the Weeper, and more recently with his own band. The Magnar was direct.
"Jarl has warned me of crows patrolling on high. Tell me all you know of these patrols."
"Tell me," John noted, "not tell us," though Jarl stood right beside him. He would have liked nothing better than to refuse the brusque demand, but he knew Stir would put him to death at the slightest disloyalty, and Ygritte as well, for the crime of being his. "There are 4 men in each patrol two rangers and two builders, he said. The builders are supposed to make note of cracks, melting, and other structural problems, while the rangers look for signs of foes. They ride mules.
Mules, the earless man frowned. Mules are slow.
Slow, but more sure-footed on the ice. The patrols often ride atop the wall, and aside from Castle Black, the paths up there have not been gravelled for long years. The mules are bred at Eastwatch, and specially trained to their duty.
They often ride atop the wall, not always.
No, one patrol in four follows the base instead, to search for cracks in the foundation ice or signs of tunnelling. The Magnar nodded.
Even in Farthen, we know the tale of Arson, Ice Axe, and his tunnel.
John knew the tale as well. Arson Ice Axe had been halfway through the wall when his tunnel was found by rangers from the Night Fort. They did not trouble to disturb him at his digging, only sealed the way behind, with ice and stone and snow. Dollar's Ed used to say that if you pressed your ear flat to the wall, you could still hear Arson chipping away with his axe.
When do these patrols go out? How often?
John shrugged. It changes. I've heard that Lord Commander Corgill used to send them out every third day from Castle Black to Eastwatch by the sea, and every second day from Castle Black to the Shadow Tower. The watch had more men in his day, though. Lord Commander Mormont prefers to vary the number of patrols and the days of their departure to make it more difficult for anyone to know their comings and goings. And sometimes the old bear will even send a larger force to one of the abandoned castles for a fortnight or a moon's turn. His uncle had originated that tactic, John knew. Anything to make the enemy on shore.
"Is Stone Door manned at present?" asked Jarl. "Greyguard?"
"So we're between these two, are we?" John kept his face carefully blank. "Only Eastwatch, Castle Black, and the Shadow Tower were manned when I left the wall. I can't speak to what Bowen Marsh or Sir Dennis might have done since."
"How many crows remain within the castle?" asked Stir.
500 at Castle Black, 200 at Shadow Tower, perhaps 300 at Eastwatch." John added 300 men to the count. If only it were that easy. Jarl was not fooled, however.
"He's lying," he told Stir, "or else including those they lost on a fist." "Crow," the Magnar warned, "do not take me for Mance Raider. If you lie to me, I will have your tongue."
"I'm no crow, and I won't be called a liar." John flexed the fingers of his sword hand. The Magnar of Then studied John with his chilly grey eyes.
"We shall learn their numbers soon enough," he said after a moment. "Go. I will send for you if I have further questions."
John bowed his head stiffly and went. If all the wildlings were like Stir, it would be easier to betray them. The Thens were not like other free folk, though. The Magna claimed to be the last of the first men and ruled with an iron hand. His little land of Thenn was a high mountain valley hidden amongst the northernmost peaks of the Frostfangs, surrounded by cave dwellers, Hornfoot men, giants, and the cannibal clans of the ice rivers. Ygritte said the Thens were savage fighters, and that their Magnar was a god to them. John could believe that. Unlike Jarl and Harmer and Rattleshirt, Stir commanded absolute obedience from his men, and that discipline was no doubt part of why Mance had chosen him to go over the wall. He walked past the Thens, sitting atop their rounded bronze helms about their cookfires. Where did Ygritte get herself to? He found her gear and his together, but no sign of the girl herself.
"She took her torch and went off that way," Grig the goat told him, pointing toward the back of the cavern.
John followed his finger and found himself in a dim back room, wandering through a maze of columns and stalactites.
"She can't be here,"
he was thinking, when he heard her laugh. He turned toward the sound, but within 10 paces he was in a dead end, facing a blank wall of rose and white flowstone. Baffled, he made his way back the way he'd come. And then he saw it. a dark hole under an outthrust of wet stone. He knelt, listened, heard the faint sound of water.
Egret! In here!
Her voice came back, echoing faintly. John had to crawl a dozen paces before the cave opened up around him. When he stood again, it took his eyes a moment to adjust. Egret had brought a torch, but there was no other light. She stood beside a little waterfall that fell from a cleft in the rock down into a wide, dark pool. The orange and yellow flames shone against the pale green water.
"What are you doing here?" he asked her. "I heard water. I wanted to see how deep the cave went."
She pointed with the torch.
"There's a passage goes down further. I followed it 100 paces before I turned back."
"A dead end?"
"You know nothing, Jon Snow. It went on and on and on. There are hundreds of caves in these hills, and deep down they all connect. There's even a way under your wall. Gorn's way."
"Gorn," said John. "Gorn was king beyond the wall."
"Aye," said Egret, "together with his brother Gendel 3,000 years ago. They led a host of free folk through the caves, and the watch was none the wiser. But when they come out, the wolves of Winterfell fell upon them."
"There was a battle," John recalled. "Gorn slew the king in the north, but his son picked up his banner and took the crown from his head and cut down Gorn in turn.
And the sound of swords woke the crows in their castles, and they rode out all in black to take the free folk in the rear."
"Yes, Gendel had the king to the south, the Umbers to the east, and the watch to the north of him. He died as well."
"You know nothing, Jon Snow. Gendel did not die. He cut his way free through the crows, and led his people back north with the wolves howling at their heels. Only Gendel did not know the caves as Gorn had, and took a wrong turn."
She swept the torch back and forth, so the shadows jumped and moved.
"Deeper he went, and deeper, and when he tried to turn back, the ways that seemed familiar ended in stone rather than sky. Soon his torches began to fail, one by one, till finally there was naught but dark. Gendel's folk were never seen again, but on a still night you can hear their children's children's children sobbing under the hills, still looking for a way back up. Listen. Do you hear them?"
All John could hear was the falling water and the faint crackle of flames. "This way under the wall was lost as well?"
"Some have searched for it. Them that go too deep find Gendel's children, and Gendel's children are always hungry."
Smiling, she set the torch carefully in the notch of rock and came toward him.
"There's naught to eat in the dark but flesh," she whispered, biting at his neck.
John nuzzled her hair and filled his nose with the smell of her.
"You sound like old Nan, telling Bran a monster story."
Egret punched his shoulder.
"An old woman, am I?"
"You're older than me."
"Aye, and wiser. You know nothing, Jon Snow."
She pushed away from him and shrugged out of her rabbit-skin vest.
"What are you doing?" "Showing you how old I am."
She unlaced her doeskin shirt, tossed it aside, pulled her 3 woolen undershirts up over her head all at once.
"I want you should see me."
"We shouldn't."
"We should."
Her breast bounced as she stood on one leg to pull one boot, then hopped onto the other foot to attend to the other. Her nipples were wide pink circles.
"You as well,"
Egret said as she yanked down her sheepskin breeches.
"If you want to look, you have to show. You know nothing, Jon Snow."
"I know I want you," he heard himself say, all his vows and all his honour forgotten. She stood before him, naked as her name day, and he was as hard as the rock around them. He had been in her 50 times by now, but always beneath the furs and with others all around them.
He had never seen how beautiful she was.
Her legs were skinny but well-muscled, the hair at the juncture of her thighs a brighter red than that on her head. Does that make it even luckier? He pulled her close. I love the smell of you, he said. I love your red hair. I love your mouth and the way you kiss me. I love your smile. I love your tits. He kissed them, one and then the other. I love your skinny legs and what's between them. He knelt to kiss her there, lightly on her mound at first. But Ygritte moved her legs apart a little, and he saw the pink inside, and kissed that as well, and tasted her. She gave a little gasp.
"If you love me all so much, why are you still dressed?" she whispered. "You know nothing, Jon Snow. Nothing.
Afterwards, she was almost shy, or as shy as Ygritte ever got.
"That thing you did,"
she said when they lay together on their piled clothes,
"with your mouth,"
she hesitated.
Is that what lords do to their ladies down in the south?
I don't think so. No one had ever told John just what lords did with their ladies. I only wanted to kiss you there, that's all. You seem to like it.
I liked it some. No one taught you such.
There's been no one, he confessed. Only you.
A maid, she teased. You were a maid.
He gave her closest nipple a playful pinch. I was a man of the night's watch.
Was?
He heard himself say. What was he now? He did not want to look at that. Were you a maid? Ygritte pushed herself onto an elbow.
I am 19, and a spear wife, and kissed by fire. How could I be maiden?
Who was he?
A boy at a feast, 5 years past. He'd come trading with his brothers, and he had hair like mine, kissed by fire, so I thought he would be lucky. But he was weak. When he came back to try and steal me, Longspear broke his arm and ran him off, and he never tried again, not once.
It wasn't Longspear, then. John was relieved. He liked Longspear, with his homely face and friendly ways. She punched him.
That's vile. Would you bed your sister?
Longspear's not your brother.
He's of my village. You know nothing, Jon Snow. A true man steals a woman from afar to strengthen the clan. Women who bed brothers or fathers or clan kin offend the gods and are cursed with weak and sickly children, even monsters.
Craster weds his daughters, John pointed out. She punched him again.
Craster's more your kind than ours. His father was a crow who stole a woman out of White Tree Village, but after he'd had her, he flew back to his wall. She went to Castle Black, once to show the crow his son, but the brothers blew their horns and run her off. Craster's blood is black, and he bears a heavy curse.
She ran her fingers lightly across his stomach.
I feared you'd do the same once, fly back to the wall. You never knew what to do after you stole me.
John sat up. Ygritte, I never stole you.
Aye, you did. You jumped down the mountain and killed Orel, and afore I could get my axe, you had a knife at my throat. I thought you'd have me then, or kill me, or maybe both. But you never did. And when I told you the tale of Bale the Bard, and how he plucked the rose of Winterfell, I thought you'd know to pluck me then for certain, but you didn't. You know nothing, Jon Snow. She gave him a shy smile. You might be learning some, though.
The light was shifting all about her, John noticed suddenly. He looked around. We'd best go up. The torch is almost done.
Is the crow afraid of Gendel's children? She said with a grin. It's only a little way up, and I am not done with you, Jon Snow.
She pushed him back down on the clothes and straddled him.
Would you...
She hesitated.
What?
He prompted, as the torch began to gutter.
Do it again?
Ygritte blurted.
With your mouth? The Lord's kiss. And I could see if you liked it any.
By the time the torch burned out, Jon Snow no longer cared. His guilt came back afterwards, but weaker than before. If this is so wrong, he wondered, why did the guards make it feel so good? The grotto was pitch dark by the time they finished. The only light was the dim glow of the passage back up to the larger cavern, where a score of fires burned. They were soon fumbling and bumping into each other as they tried to dress in the dark. Ygritte stumbled into the pool and screeched at the cold of the water. When John laughed, she pulled him in too. They wrestled and splashed in the dark, and then she was in his arms again, and it turned out they were not finished after all.
"John Snow," she told him, when he'd spent his seed inside her, "don't move now, sweet. I like the feel of you in there. I do. Let's not go back to Stir and Jarl. Let's go down inside and join up with Gendel's children. I don't ever want to leave this cave, Jon Snow. Not ever."
Daenerys. "All?" The slave girl sounded weary.
"Your Grace, did this one's worthless ears mishear you?"
Cool green light filtered down through the diamond-shaped panes of coloured glass set in the sloping triangular walls, and a breeze was blowing gently through the terrace doors, carrying the scents of fruit and flowers from the garden beyond. "Your ears heard true," said Danny. "I want to buy them all. Tell the good masters, if you will." She had chosen a Carthian gown today. The deep violet silk brought out the purple of her eyes. The cut of it bared her left breast. While the good masters of Astapor conferred among themselves in low voices, Danny sipped tart persimmon wine from a tall silver flute. She could not quite make out all they were saying, but she could hear the greed. Each of the 8 brokers was attended by 2 or 3 body slaves, though one, Grasden, the eldest, had 6. So as not to seem a beggar, Danny had brought her own attendants, Iri and Jiqui, in their sand-silk trousers and painted vests, Old Whitebeard and Mighty Belwas, her blood riders. Sir Jorah stood behind her, sweltering in his green surcoat with a black bear of Mormont embroidered upon it. The smell of his sweat was an earthy answer to the sweet perfumes that drenched the Astapori.
"All," growled Krasny's Monaklos, who smelled of peaches today.
The slave girl repeated the word in the common tongue of Westeros.
"Of thousands there are 8. Is this what she means by all? There are also 6 centuries, who shall be part of a 9,000 when complete. Would she have them too?"
"I would," said Danny when the question was put to her. "The 8,000s, the 6 centuries, and the ones still in training as well, the ones who have not earned the spikes." Krasny's turned back to his fellows. Once again they conferred amongst themselves. The translator had told Danny their names, but it was hard to keep them straight. 4 of the men seemed to be named Grasden, presumably after Grasden the Great, who had founded Old Gis in the dawn of days. They all looked alike, thick, fleshy men with amber skin, broad noses, dark eyes. Their wiry hair was black, or dark red, or a queer mixture of red and black that was peculiar to Giscari. All wrapped themselves in tokars, a garment permitted only to freeborn men of Astapor. It was the fringe of the tokar that proclaimed a man's status, Danny had been told by Captain Grolier. In this cool green room atop the pyramid, 2 of the slavers wore tokars fringed in silver, 5 had gold fringes, and 1, the oldest Grasden, displayed a fringe of fat white pearls that clacked together softly when he shifted in his seat or moved an arm.
"We cannot sell half-trained boys,"
one of the silver-fringed Grasdens was saying to the others.
"We can, if her gold is good, eh?"
said a fatter man whose fringe was gold.
"They are not unsullied. They have not killed their sucklings. If they fail in the field, they will shame us. And even if we cut 5,000 war boys tomorrow, it would be 10 years before they are fit for sale. What would we tell the next buyer who comes seeking unsullied?"
"We will tell him that he must wait, eh?"
said the fat man.
"Gold in my purse is better than gold in my future."
Danny let them argue, sipping the tart persimmon wine, and trying to keep her face blank and ignorant. "I will have them all, no matter the price," she told herself. The city had 100 slave traders, but the 8 before her were the greatest. When selling bed slaves, field hands, scribes, craftsmen, and tutors, these men were rivals. But their ancestors had allied one with the other for the purpose of making and selling the unsullied. Brick and blood built Astapor, and brick and blood her people. It was Krasnys who finally announced their decision.
"Tell her that the 8,000 she shall have, if her gold proves sufficient, and the 6 centuries if she wishes. Tell her to come back in a year, and we will sell her another 2,000.
"In a year I shall be in Westeros," said Danny, when she heard the translation. "My need is now. The Unsullied are well trained, but even so many will fall in battle. I shall need the boys as replacements to take up the swords they drop." She put her wine aside and leaned toward the slave girl. "Tell the good masters that I will want even the little ones who still have their puppies. Tell them that I will pay as much for the boy they cut yesterday as for an unsullied in a spiked helm." The girl told him. The answer was still no. Danny frowned in annoyance. "Very well. Tell them I will pay double, so long as I get them all."
"Double, eh?"
The fat one in the gold fringe all but drooled.
"This little whore is a fool, truly," said Krasnys Monaklos. "Ask her for triple, I say. She is desperate enough to pay. Ask for 10 times the price of every slave, yes."
The tall Grasden, with a spiked beard, spoke in the common tongue, though not so well as a slave girl.
"Your Grace," he growled, "Westeros is being wealthy, yes, but you are not being queen now. Perhaps will never being queen. Even Unsullied may be losing battles to savage steel knights of 7 kingdoms. I am reminding the good masters of Astapor are not selling flesh for promises. Are you having gold and trading goods sufficient to be paying for all these eunuchs you are wanting?"
"You know the answer to that better than I, good master," Danny replied. "Your men have gone through my ships and tallied every bead of amber and jar of saffron. How much do I have?"
Sufficient to be buying 1 of 1,000s, the good master said with a contemptuous smile. "Yet you are paying double, you are seeing. 5 centuries, then, is all you buy."
"Your pretty crown made by another century," said the fat one in Valyrian. "Your crown of the 3 dragons.
Danny waited for his words to be translated. "My crown is not for sale. When Viserys sold their mother's crown, the last joy had gone from him, leaving only rage. Nor will I enslave my people, nor sell their goods and horses. But my ships you can have. The great cog, Balerion, and the galleys, Vagar and Maraxes." She had warned Grolio and the other captains it might come to this, though they had protested the necessity of it furiously. 3 good ships should be worth more than a few paltry eunuchs. The fat Grasden turned to the others. They conferred in low voices once again.
2 of the 1,000s,
the one with the spiked beard said when he turned back.
"It is too much, but the good masters are being generous, and your need is being great."
2,000 would never serve for what she meant to do. "I must have them all." Danny knew what she must do now, though the taste of it was so bitter that even the persimmon wine could not cleanse it from her mouth. She had considered long and hard, and found no other way. "It is my only choice." "Give me all," she said, "and you may have a dragon." There was a sound of indrawn breath from Jiqui beside her. Krasnys smiled at his fellows.
"Did I not tell you, eh? Anything she would give us."
Whitebeard stared in shocked disbelief. His hand trembled where it grasped the staff.
"No."
He went to one knee before her.
"Your Grace, I beg you, win your throne with dragons, not slaves. You must not do this thing."
"You must not presume to instruct me. Sir Jorah, remove Whitebeard from my presence." Mormont seized the old man roughly by an elbow, yanked him back to his feet, and marched him out onto the terrace. "Tell the good masters I regret this interruption," said Danny to the slave girl. "Tell them I await their answer." She knew the answer, though. She could see it in the glitter of their eyes and the smiles they tried so hard to hide. Astapor had thousands of eunuchs and even more slave boys waiting to be cut, but there were only 3 living dragons in all the great wide world. And the Giskari lust for dragons. How could they not? 5 times had old Gis contended with Valyria when the world was young, and 5 times gone down to bleak defeat. For the Freehold had dragons, and the Empire had none. The oldest Grasdon stirred in his seat, and his pearls clacked together softly.
"A dragon of our choice," he said in a thin, hard voice. "The Black One is largest and healthiest."
"His name is Drogon," she nodded.
"All your goods, save your crown and your queenly raiment, which we will allow you to keep. The 3 ships and Drogon."
"Done," she said, in the common tongue.
"Done,"
the old Grasdon answered in his thick Valyrian. The others echoed that old man of the pearl fringe.
"Done," the slave girl translated, and done, 8 times done."
"The Unsullied will learn your savage tongue quick enough,"
added Krasnys Monaclus, when all the arrangements had been made.
"But until such time, you will need a slave to speak to them. Take this one as our gift to you, a token of our bargain well struck."
"I shall," said Danny. The slave girl rendered his words to her and hers to him. If she had feelings about being given for a token, she took care not to let them show. Aston Whitebeard held his tongue as well when Danny swept by him on the terrace. He followed her down the steps in silence, but she could hear his hardwood staff tap-tapping on the red bricks as they went. She did not blame him for his fury. It was a wretched thing she did. The mother of dragons has sold her strongest child. Even the thought made her ill. Yet down in the Plaza of Pride, standing on the hot red bricks between the slaver's pyramid and the barracks of the eunuchs, Danny turned on the old man. "Whitebeard," she said, "I want your counsel, and you should never fear to speak your mind with me, when we are alone, but never question me in front of strangers. Is that understood?"
"Yes, your grace,"
he said unhappily. "I am not a child," she told him. "I am a queen."
"Yet even queens can err. The Astapori have cheated you, your grace. A dragon is worth more than any army. Aegon proved that 300 years ago, upon the Field of Fire."
"I know what Aegon proved. I mean to prove a few things of my own." Danny turned away from him to the slave girl standing meekly beside her litter. "Do you have a name, or must you draw a new one every day from some barrel?"
"That is only her Unsullied," the girl said,
and she realized the question had been asked in High Valyrian. Her eyes went wide.
"Oh,
your name is O?"
"No, your grace, forgive this one her outburst. Your slave's name is Masandi, but—"
"Masandi is no longer a slave. I free you from this instant. Come ride with me in the litter. I wish to talk." Ricardo helped them in, and Danny drew the curtains shut against the dust and heat. "If you stay with me, you will serve as one of my handmaids," she said, as they set off. "I shall keep you by my side to speak for me as you spoke for Krasnys. But you may leave my service whenever you choose, if you have a father or a mother you would sooner return to."
"This one will stay," the girl said. "This one, there is no place for me to go. This I will serve you gladly."
"I can give you freedom, but not safety," Danny warned. "I have a world to cross, and wars to fight. You may go hungry. You may grow sick. You may be killed."
"Vela Morgulloth," said Missandei in High Valyrian.
"All men must die," Danny agreed, "but not for a long while, we may pray." She leaned back on the pillows and took the girl's hand. "Are these Unsullied truly fearless?"
"Yes, your grace."
"You serve me now. Is it true they feel no pain?
The wine of courage kills such feelings. By the time they slay the sucklings, they have been drinking it for years.
And they are obedient?
Obedience is all they know. If you told them not to breathe, they would find that easier than not to obey.
Danny nodded. And when I am done with them?
Your Grace?
When I have won my war and claimed the throne that was my father's, my knights will sheathe their swords and return to their keeps, to their wives and children and mothers, to their lives. But these eunuchs have no lives. What am I to do with 8,000 eunuchs when there are no more battles to be fought?
The Unhallowed make fine gods, and Eklund a watchman.
Your Grace, said Melisandre.
And it is never hard to find a buyer for such fine, well-blooded troops.
Men are not bought and sold in Westeros, they tell me.
With all respect, Your Grace, Unsullied are not men.
If I did resell them, how would I know they could not be used against me? Danny asked pointedly. Would they do that? Fight against me? Even do me harm?
If their master commanded, they do not question, Your Grace. All the questions have been culled from them. They obey.
She looked troubled.
When you are done with them, Your Grace might command them to fall upon their swords.
And even that they would do?
Yes.
Miss Andy's voice had grown soft.
Your Grace.
Danny squeezed her hand. You would sooner I did not ask it of them, though. Why is that? Why do you care?
Oh, the swan does not... Your Grace...
Tell me. The girl lowered her eyes.
Three of them were my brothers once, Your Grace.
Then I hope your brothers are as brave and clever as you. Danny leaned back into her pillow and let the litter bear her onward, back to Valerian one last time to set her world in order. And back to Drogon. Her mouth set grimly. It was a long, dark, windy night that followed. Danny fed her dragons, as she always did, but found she had no appetite herself. She cried a while, alone in her cabin, then dried her tears long enough for yet another argument with Grolio. Magister Illyrio is not here, she finally had to tell him. And if he was, he could not sway me either. I need the Unsullied more than I need these ships, and I will hear no more about it. The anger burned the grief and fear from her for a few hours at the least. Afterward she called her blood riders to her cabin with Ser Jorah. They were the only ones she truly trusted. She meant to sleep afterward, to be well rested for the morrow, but an hour of restless tossing in the stuffy confines of the cabin soon convinced her that that was hopeless. Outside her door she found Aegor fitting a new string to his bow by the light of a swinging oil lamp. Rakaro sat cross-legged on the deck beside him, sharpening his arrack with a whetstone. Danny told them both to keep on with what they were doing, and went up on deck for a taste of the cool night air. The crew left her alone as they went about their business, but Ser Jorah soon joined her by the rail. He is never far, Danny thought. He knows my moods too well.
Khaleesi, you ought to be asleep. Tomorrow will be hot and hard, I promise you. You'll need your strength.
Do you remember Aroa? She asked him.
The Lazarine girl?
They were raping her, but I stopped them and took her under my protection. Only when my son and Stars was dead, Mago took her back, used her again, and killed her. Aegor said it was her fate.
I remember, Ser Jorah said.
I was alone for a long time, Jorah. All alone, but for my brother. I was such a small, scared thing. Viserys should have protected me, but instead he hurt me and scared me worse. He shouldn't have done that. He wasn't just my brother, he was my king. Why do the guards make kings and queens if not to protect the ones who can't protect themselves?
Some kings make themselves. Robert did.
He was no true king, Danny said scornfully. He did no justice. Justice. That's what kings are for. Ser Jorah had no answer. He only smiled and touched her hair, so lightly. It was enough. That night she dreamt that she was Rhaegar, riding to the Trident. But she was mounted on a dragon, not a horse. When she saw the usurper's rebel host across the river, they were armored all in ice, but she bathed them in dragonfire, and they melted away like dew and turned the Trident into a torrent. Some small part of her knew that she was dreaming, but another part exulted. This is how it was meant to be. The other was a nightmare, and I've only now awakened. She woke suddenly in the darkness of her cabin, still flush with triumph. Valyrian seemed to wake with her, and she heard the faint creak of wood, water lapping against the hull, a footfall on the deck above her head, and something else. Someone was in the cabin with her. Iri? Shiqui? Where are you? Her handmaids did not respond. It was too black to see, but she could hear them breathing. Jorah, is that you?
I sleep,
a woman said.
You sleep?
The voice was very close.
Even dragons must sleep.
She is standing over me. Who's there? Danny peered into the darkness. She thought she could see a shadow, the faintest outline of a shape. What do you want of me?
Remember, to go north, you must journey south. To reach the west, you must go east. To go forward, you must go back. And to touch the light, you must pass beneath the shadow.
Quaithe? Danny sprung from her bed and threw open the door. Pale yellow lantern light flooded the cabin, and Iri and Jiqui sat up sleepily.
Khaleesi?
Murmured Jiqui, rubbing her eyes. Viserion woke and opened his jaws, and a puff of flame brightened even the darkest corners. There was no sign of a woman in a red lacquer mask.
Khaleesi, are you unwell?
Asked Jiqui. A dream. Danny shook her head. I dreamed a dream. No more. Go back to sleep. All of us. Go back to sleep. Yet try as she might, sleep would not come again. If I look back, I am lost, Danny told herself the next morning as she entered Astapor through the harbour gates. She dared not remind herself how small and insignificant her following truly was, or she would lose all courage. Today she rode her silver, clad in horsehair pants and painted leather vest, a bronze medallion belt about her waist and two more crossed between her breasts. Iri and Jiqui had braided her hair and hung it with a tiny silver bell, whose chime sang of the undying of Karth, burned in their palace of dust. The red brick streets of Astapor were almost crowded this morning. Slaves and servants lined the ways, while the slavers and their women donned their tokars to look down from their stepped pyramids. They are not so different from Carthene, after all, she thought. They want a glimpse of dragons to tell their children of, and their children's children. It made her wonder how many of them would ever have children. Aego went before her with his great Dothraki bow. Strong Belwas walked to the right of her mare, the girl Missandei to her left. Ser Jorah Mormont was behind, in mail and surcoat, glowering at anyone who came too near. Ricardo and Jogo protected the litter. Danny had commanded that the top be removed so her three dragons might be chained to the platform. Iri and Jiqui rode with them to try and keep them calm. Yet Viserion's tail lashed back and forth, and smoke rose angry from his nostrils. Rhaegal could sense something wrong as well. Thrice he tried to take wing, only to be pulled down by the heavy chain in Jiqui's hand. Drogon coiled into a ball, wings and tail tucked tight. Only his eyes remained to tell that he was not asleep. The rest of her people followed. Grolio and the other captains and their crews, and the 83 Dothraki who remained to her of the 100,000 who had once ridden in Drogo's Khalasar. She put the oldest and weakest on the inside of the column, with the nursing women and those with child, and the little girls and the boys too young to braid their hair. The rest, Her warriors, such as they were, rode outside and moved their dismal herd along.